And I think that the popularity of the party is simply tanked because of just how out of proportion these alleged corruption scandals have become.
Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Leo Kamer. On November 19th, Malaysia held its parliamentary elections, resulting in a narrow victory for now Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. In this episode, we discuss the issues most important in the election, the composition of the new governing coalition, and Anwar Ibrahim's plans for Malaysia. Joining me to share his expertise on this transfer of power is Sebastian Strangio. Sebastian is the Southeast Asia editor at The Diplomat, and he has reported extensively on nations across Southeast Asia. Sebastian's writing has appeared in leading publications including Foreign Affairs, the Los Angeles Review of Books, the New York Times, The Diplomat, and Nikkei Asian Review, among many others. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Sebastian, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure.
In late November, Malaysia held parliamentary elections, and Anwar Ibrahim became the country's prime minister after a narrow victory and a few days of wrangling a coalition together. Can you start us off by telling us what issues dominated this election cycle? In other words, to voters, what was on the ballot?
Well, this election followed an unusual period of instability in Malaysian politics. To set the background, you have to understand that from 1957, the country's independence from Great Britain, until 2018, Malaysia was ruled by a single coalition, Barisan Nasional, which translates as the National Front, dominated by a party called UMNO, the United Malays National Organization, that ruled in a virtually unbroken stretch from 1957 till 2018. The 2018 election saw the BN's shock defeat to a multiracial progressive coalition called Pakatan Harapan, which is also the coalition that has just assumed power under Anwar. Basically, I think that a lot of Malaysian voters, you know, had become tired of the sort of the instability of politics over the past few years. The PH coalition that took power in 2018 collapsed after 2 years amid, you know, political infighting within the coalition. And Malaysia got, you know, a series of unelected and unstable coalition governments that, you know, that were in charge of the country during a period of considerable challenge. COVID-19, the economic ramifications of that, rising cost of living, and all these sorts of things. I think that people have gotten sick of, you had gotten sick of politicians' games. They wanted stable and, you know, and relatively clean government. Whether this election has delivered something that will restore stability to Malaysian politics, of course, remains to be seen.
Maybe you can tell us a little more about how Anwar hopes to tackle these issues of rising cost of living and what you call clean government, or an aspiration to clean government.
I mean, Anwar has you know, had an anti-corruption agenda for many, many years. I mean, for most of the time, obviously, he's been howling from the wilderness about, you know, the corrupt nature of mainstream Malaysian politics. And now that he's finally, at the age of 75 years, you know, attained his ambition of reaching the summit of the country's politics, he's now in a position potentially to start actually implementing this. You know, doing so will be very difficult. I think that, so first of all, he's, you know, the cost of living is something that he's pledged to tackle first, and he's made a number of moves in that direction. He's ordered the government to review Malaysia's system of cost of living subsidies to ensure that these subsidies don't benefit the wealthy and that go primarily to the people that need them the most. I think this is a smart move by Anwar to tackle this, because it is potentially an issue that could unite various political camps and people from different ethnic groups. You have everybody faces cost of living pressures, and you know, I think Anwar is going to attempt to stabilize his coalition by appealing to sort of the pocketbook concerns of ordinary Malaysians. The question of corruption is a lot more complex. I mean, you know, rooting out entrenched patronage and cronyism in any political system is a huge challenge, because these sorts of ways of doing things become customary. They also are very rooted in the ethnic Malay nationalist sort of agenda in Malaysian politics, which of course BN during its decades in power, you know, very much based its rule around this idea that Malays who are the majority in Malaysia, but you know, have historically felt threatened by ethnic Chinese and ethnic Indians whose ancestors were brought into Malaya during the British period to you know, work on plantations and in tin mines. The sense of, you know, that the Malays are becoming strangers in their own land and that they need a help from the government in order to sort of, you know, become more prosperous and rise up to the level of the Chinese, who historically have been very, have been economically sort of prosperous. Mm-hmm. You know, that agenda has underpinned BN's politics from the very beginning and continues to be very salient despite BN's loss of support at this election. And I think that, you know, the close connection of patronage to this, you know, and sort of corruption to this mode of politics is going to be very hard to untangle. And of course, that speaks to the larger challenge that Anwar is going to face in dealing with and trying to assert a sort of multiracial, multi-ethnic, inclusive and capacious, notion of Malaysian identity in the face of this sort of persistent Malay nationalism.
And I'm wondering how has this corruption or patronage manifested in Malaysia? Is it along mostly these ethnic lines, or is it more a general elite class, or something else entirely?
Well, Malaysia has a system of basically affirmative action for Malays, which is kind of a strange situation from say an American perspective, where minorities are benefited from affirmative action in college admissions and so forth. In the case of Malaysia, Malays are a majority of the population, but they enjoy all sorts of benefits. Now this means that, you know, government linked companies, which are sort of like, I guess, sort of state-owned enterprises, you know, these are companies that can only be headed by Malays as a matter of law, and so this creates a lot of incentives for kickbacks among, you know, senior politicians and people in the business world. You know, vote buying is very common in Malaysian elections. You know, people being offered cash inducements to come to protests or to vote the right way. The idea that the Malay BN and sort of these Malay parties have been sort of patrons of, you know, the ethnic Malay villages out, you know, predominantly rural areas, you know, is something that has created a habit of a fairly, you know, everybody, you know, greasing the wheels to make sure that everybody gets their, you know, little piece of the action. You know, and that in recent years has broadened out into a much more serious issue with corruption. Under Prime Minister Najib Razak, we saw who's now in prison, we saw the 1MDB corruption scandal, which was basically the wholesale theft of a sovereign wealth fund that was created in 2009, shortly after Najib was elected to power. And this, I think, is what this is. One can ascribe BN's loss of popularity and loss of support to precisely the 1MDB scandal. But that was the point at which corruption became, you know, so large scale that it was something that couldn't even be justified. I think previously there had always been people creaming off a little bit off the top and some kickbacks going this way and that. But, you know, major infrastructure projects got built. Malaysia did advance economically. Ordinary people benefited. A middle class emerged in Malaysia. I think that, you know, the 1MDB scandal was sort of a pure form of theft that really, I think, angered a lot of people and certainly damaged Malaysia's reputation internationally. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, the patron-client relationships between the old BN machinery and the grassroots of you know, the Malaysian villages, you know, that there was a sort of relationship there that was conducive to corrupt activities. You know, whether that persists under you know, the other Malay parties, you know, I suppose remains to be seen.
Does Anwar's coalition hope to do away with the legal the legally enshrined preferential treatment for ethnic Malays, or is that sort of an untouchable issue?
That's pretty untouchable. It's sort of the third rail of Malaysian politics, if because you know there is a whole swath of the Malaysian political landscape that is dedicated to the preservation of these. I mean, even the suggestion that they might be dismantled brings people into the streets. There was a plan by the PH government after 2018 to ratify a UN convention against racial discrimination, and that was viewed as an attack on Malay privileges. And so I think that it's going to be an incredibly difficult thing for them to do, and they're going to have to sort of toe a very fine line in seeking to govern for all of Malaysia, while also sort of leaving, the system of preferences intact. I think that the dismantling of the system will be very much a long-term project.
So having discussed all these issues, we can move to a more specific view of Anwar's coalition. The result of these elections was a hung parliament. That means no party won a majority of seats. And so the coalition that now rules Malaysia had to be formed in order to achieve a parliamentary majority. Can you take us through the relevant parties in Anwar's government coalition and what factions they represent?
Well, it's hard to sum up neatly. The National Unity Government that Anwar has formed includes just about everybody except the Perikatan Nasional coalition, which was sort of which had been previously enjoyed a prominent position in the last coalition government. But so within, obviously we have, first of all, Anwar's own coalition, Pakatan Harapan, which is dominated by his PKR party and the Democratic Action Party, which is historically a predominantly ethnic Chinese urban party. The PH coalition, leans to the left. It is multi-ethnic and advocates a multi-ethnic notion of Malaysian identity. It also sort of believes that its mandate from 2018 was stolen or co-opted in 2020 when the coalition collapsed due to the defection of MPs from the coalition and the formation of a new ethnic Malay centered coalition government under PN, the current opposition. PH is also committed to fighting corruption and as I mentioned earlier. The next component is Barisan Nasional and UMNO, which is slightly strange considering that, this is the party that Anwar spent, even though he was initially a member of UMNO, has spent most of his career fighting. But somewhat paradoxically, BN performed very poorly at this election, winning just 30 seats. But it was in a position to sort of act as a kingmaker, and its support was crucial in the formation of any coalition government. So it finds itself somewhat strangely in government as a junior partner in Anwar's coalition. The next important coalition is a coalition called GPS, which is based in Sarawak State on the island of Borneo in eastern Malaysia. This is basically a Sarawak first party that focuses on, promoting, autonomy for this region and ensuring that the resources of the region predominantly serve the people of Sarawak. It is not a party that has a national presence, but it holds a lot of seats. Historically, the eastern Malaysian, the Bornean provinces have often been able to serve as sort of the swing vote in Malaysian politics. And that's becoming more the case in the current fractured political landscape. In addition to that, there's another political coalition based in Sabah on Borneo, and a smattering of other independents and small parties that are supporting Anwar's government. It includes four coalitions and a total of 18 political parties. So we're talking about an incredibly fractured and fragmented political landscape. The biggest question, I suppose, at the moment is whether UMNO and BN, used to being in the driver's seat and who'd planned that this election would catapult them back to their rightful place as the leading party of Malaysia, how they will interact with Anwar's coalition. Will they support his coalition and its agenda in a genuine attempt to restore stability to Malaysian politics, or will they sort of White Ant, his administration, you know, threaten to defect and dissolve, it lead to the dissolution of parliament. You know, how will they react to Anwar's anti-corruption platform and his desire to, you know, his sort of multi-ethnic agenda? You know, all of these things remain to be seen. I think, you know, it's very likely that UMNO sees itself as a kingmaker and hopes to be the deciding factor, you know, as a way of sort of preserving some remnant of the power that it once wielded in Malaysian politics. And it could always threaten to walk away as well, which would you know, doom Anwar's government to, you know, will potentially plunge Malaysia back into a new period of instability and horse trading. But the, you know, the collapse of BN has led to, you know, an unprecedented degree of instability and fragmentation in Malaysian politics. And I think, you know, it remains to be seen whether Anwar will be able to hold together this coalition for any significant period of time.
Right. I mean, it's easy for Anwar to come up and make all these claims, but ultimately he has all these factions to deal with. And so understandably, we don't really know where the cards are going to fall when it comes to keeping that government together. I was wondering, has BN or any other coalition member made explicit demands, like policy demands of the government?
Not that I'm aware of so far. I mean, I haven't been following it that closely to, you know, the sort of the real nitty gritty of what's been happening the last few weeks under the new government. I mean, it seems to be Anwar that's setting the policy agenda at the moment, but no doubt these parties will seek to advance various claims, and there will be a lot of backroom negotiations and maneuvering within the coalition to ensure that everybody's agenda is satisfied.
And I mean, this is hard to predict, obviously, but what sort of policies would these smaller sub-coalitions or the smaller members of the grand coalition request? What sort of policy prescriptions would they want?
Well, one would presume that UMNO would seek for the preservation and extension of Malay privilege. That's something that, you know, is longstanding. And so any attempt to sort of step away from that, even incrementally, would be met with its opposition. You know, the Sarawak and Sabah-based parties are obviously going to be interested in policies that strengthen their autonomy. You know, there is some controversy about an agreement that was signed in 1963, which when the Malaysian Federation was formed, this is when Sabah and Sarawak joined Malaysia. Previously, it had just been the peninsular part of the country. And when they joined, there was sort of pledges made about autonomy for these regions. So I think that the Bornean parties are, you know, will likely continue to press their agenda, their local agenda of extending, you know, the amount of autonomy that they have in terms of the natural resources that these regions contain, and also their, you know, you know, where they sit within the administrative hierarchy of the Malaysian Federation. I think, you know, that's roughly it. I mean, and then there's smaller parties, which probably have, more micro agendas, potentially focused in certain constituencies. I'm not enough of a specialist in Malaysian politics to know, you know, the really fine grained sort of detail about what each of these, the smaller parties will seek to achieve, because a lot of them are, you know, they do have a very, they have local, you know, provincial bases, and some of them only hold a handful of seats, which would mean that they, you know, that their interests would potentially be, you know, reflect the needs of their specific constituencies to a greater extent than the national parties.
And so, we have this dramatic fall of BN from power, which has led it into this junior partner position where it may get to call the shots, but we're not really sure. Or it may be a gatekeeper for Anwar's policy, and we already discussed the reasons why that coalition has lost popularity: the corruption scandals, the rising cost of living, handling of COVID. But why did voters turn to Anwar or PH or any of these sort of winners of the election?
Well, I mean, the verdict rendered by the Malaysian electorate was hardly binding. You know, as you pointed out before, it resulted in a hung parliament. No party had the majority necessary to rule alone. And so, you know, voters, you know, did turn out in, you know, considerable numbers to support the PH coalition. But there was also a considerable amount of support for the now opposition, the Perikatan Nasional coalition, which is an ethnic Malay Muslim, right-wing formation. In particular, while Anwar's victory after so many years of striving was, of course, the sort of the main plot point of this election, the B plot was really the emergence of PAS, Malaysia's largest Islamic party, which of course was part of the PN coalition, is now in opposition. PAS won 43 seats in parliament, which is the largest of any single political party. It has established itself, as a real force beyond the sort of provinces where it had previously established control at the state level. And, it advocates, the extension of certain elements of Islamic Sharia law, and is very hostile to the idea of a multi-ethnic Malaysia. There's evidence that it, on social media, PAS was coordinating, racially charged messages about, the loss of Malay privileges, if the opposition were to, PH were to come to power. It is likely, there's a sort of contradiction in how this election turned out, which is that it resulted in a multi-ethnic governing coalition, but it also represented it was served as a reminder that the, ethnic Malay politics remains very much a salient feature of Malaysian politics. And also the increasing definition of Malay identity in Islamic terms. I think we can look at PAS's success and argue that Malay identity politics are also to some extent becoming Islamic identity politics. And being Malay is becoming associated with being Islamic, being Muslim. And that's simply reinforcing the distinction between the Malay population in Malaysia and the Indian and the Chinese populations, which are the vast majority of whom are not Muslim. I think that BN's loss of support was largely due to the 1MDB scandal and the corruption that has flourished at the upper echelons of the party. The UMNO president is facing a raft of corruption charges of his own. And I think that the popularity of the party is simply tanked because of just how out of proportion these alleged corruption scandals have become. This did not represent a defeat for ethnic Malay privileges or ethnic Malay politics. Indeed, I think that the mantle of sort of the party that represents the Malay heartland has really passed to PN and within PN, PAS is playing a more prominent role, and so I think that's going to pose a huge challenge to Anwar, because he's going to he's governing a multi-ethnic coalition at a time when ethnic Malay politics and the idea of Malay identity being sort of associated with what it means to be Malaysian have potentially never been stronger.
Given the identification of Malay ethnic identity with Islam, might we see elements of Islamic law passed in Malaysia's legal system, especially with Indonesia, Malaysia's neighbor, having adopted more religious laws recently?
Yeah, I mean, both countries have experienced, the rise of a sort of Islamic exclusivism in recent years. And there are similar features, obviously, at play in both cases. I think that in Malaysia, I think it's too soon to sort of leap to the conclusion that Sharia law is going to sort of be imposed at a national level. I think that PAS, it has emerged as a national political player, but it's not able to simply call the shots. It has already introduced, elements of Islamic law at the state level in the four states in the northern part of the Malay Peninsula that it has established its control at the state level. And so we've already seen the party spearhead this sort of, morality codes and things of that nature. I mean, I think that, in opposition, its current, role will be to protest, if necessary, in the street, any threat to, or even perceived threat to Malay privileges. And I think that, we're probably going to see if the Anwar government, even takes, a small step in that direction, PAS calling, red shirt Malay ultras into the streets in order to, ensure that, you know, Malay supremacy, as it's known in Malaysia, remains in place. And I think that over the longer term, I think the rise of PAS signifies, you know, a hardening of the ethnic and sectarian lines in Malaysia, which is definitely worrying. I think it's more likely to result in, you know, if a coalition comes to power in which PAS occupies a significant position in a future election, you could see certain ministerial portfolios falling into the hands of Islamic conservatives. And you could see, you know, an exacerbation of current trends, which is, you know, in the case of the Malaysian Chinese community, we see large levels of brain drain emigration, as, you know, Chinese Malaysians who you know, face a lot of obstacles within Malaysia due to the system of preferences for Malays, you know, increasingly see benefits in migrating either to the West or to Singapore or to you know, other parts of the world where they are more able to sort of flourish, I suppose. And this is something that's been happening over a long period of time. And standing in the background of this is a steady demographic decline in the number of Chinese Malaysians. And as they become more and more of a minority, they become politically expendable, and, you know, things could become, you know, more tense. I mean, this is a very long-term trend, and it's hard to speak confidently about that. But I do think the rise of PAS signifies, you know, a considerable challenge to the emergence of a consensus around a multi-ethnic Malaysia. And I think that, you know, it signifies that the lines between these different ethnic communities are, you know, becoming deeper and thicker.
I'd next like to touch on Malaysia's foreign policy. Malaysia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs claims that its foreign policy is driven by its strategic location in Southeast Asia, its attributes as a trading nation, as well as its unique demography. I mean, this is sort of a switch from what we've been talking about earlier, but I think it's important to discuss. How has Malaysia's foreign policy reflected these factors, especially in recent years? And might things change after this election?
I mean, I don't see any significant change. I think that what we saw under PH in 2018 was a lot of rhetoric against China and Chinese investments in Malaysia. A lot of that had to do with the corrupt and opaque nature of some of these projects that the Najib government had contracted. You know, multi-billion-dollar projects, which later turned out may have been inflated, the value of which may have been inflated in order to sort of help the government plug the massive debt hole in the 1MDB fund, which had been, you know, basically robbed and pilfered by, you know, various individuals. There was a considerable backlash against these big Belt and Road Initiative projects. But what ended up happening is that once the PH coalition got into power in 2018, you know, it reviewed a number of these projects, canceled a couple of them, but continued to advocate good relations with China. And I think it's important not to transfer, you know, Anwar's desire for a more progressive vision for Malaysia to the international sphere. I think he is going to seek to preserve Malaysia's fruitful trading relationship with China. You know, Malaysia is China's largest trading partner in Southeast Asia. You know, the country's last year, I think it was something like $170 billion in trade. And I think that he'll probably, you know, to the extent that Chinese projects come under scrutiny, it will be more for whether these projects serve Malaysian interests. But it's not going to reflect the sort of anti-China, you know, position that we see in Western capitals now, where China is sort of viewed as a, you know, an adversary and a systemic challenge. I think that Malaysia sees a lot of benefits in trading with China, maintaining economic growth and prosperity for the Malaysian people relies to some extent on trade and investment from China. And so I think that we'll see potentially a curbing of some of the excesses under Anwar, but otherwise a preservation of what is a very fruitful relationship. You know, and I think that Malaysia, you know, like the rest of Southeast Asia, sees no reason why it can't continue to enjoy the benefits of trade and investment with China, and also the protection of, you know, the US security umbrella in the Pacific. And I think that Malaysia, like its neighbors, will continue to try and sort of maintain this balance and to push back against any American or Chinese attempt to sort of frame, you know, U.S.-China competition in a binary way and force nations to make a binding decision about which nation they're going to support. And I think that it's managed this with a fair degree of success in recent decades since China's emergence from the Maoist era. And so I see no reason why it won't be able to continue to do so for the short to medium term. I mean, a lot of that depends, of course, on decisions that are made in Washington and Beijing.
Mm-hmm. And it's clear how Malaysia has benefited from trade with China, but could you go a little more into the specifics of how Malaysia has benefited from American security support, or the security umbrella, as you call it?
Well, I mean, this it is sort of, in some ways, the presence, you know, the forward deployed presence of the U.S. Navy and the armed forces have sort of Malaysia hasn't needed to invest so heavily in its own defense. It can sort of fall back on you know the fact that the U.S. is going into is playing a prominent role in pushing back against Chinese claims in the South China Sea. You know, this is something that Malaysia doesn't speak very, very strongly about. You know, you can compare Malaysia to the position of the Philippines, which is much more outspoken generally. Even under Duterte, you know, the diplomatic protests filed by the Philippine Ministry of Foreign Affairs were a lot more, they were much more significant than anything that's any protests made by the Malaysians. I think the writer Robert Kaplan once wrote that American power, you know, gives Malaysia the luxury of its national ambiguity. And I think that that will likely continue. I mean, you see a lot that the head of the Malaysian Navy, most of the recent heads of the Malaysian Navy have been educated in the United States. Previously, they would have been at Sandhurst in the United Kingdom. Now they're being educated at, you know, naval academies in the United States. There is a strong but relatively quiet defense partnership between the United States and Malaysia. And I think that, that seems set to continue. I think the Americans will want to continue to bolster that. Malaysia will try to balance that against, you know, the Chinese concerns, of course, and to sort of maintain a sort of, a careful balance between, you know, economic relations with China and security relations with the United States. But I think the country is at the moment in a fairly sweet position between the two, provided that tensions between China and the U.S. don't get, don't move toward the precipice of open conflict. I think that Malaysia's in a good position to continue to profit from both.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on the podcast, Sebastian. This was a very informative episode.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.